Sic parvis magna. Greatness from small beginnings, as the Romans might have said. That's the outcome they're hoping for here at this Equinox Summit, which for 5 days now has been examining our energy future. Tonight, the wrap-up. What will we do to get to a low-carbon, electrified future by the year 2030? That's next on this special edition of The Agenda, live tonight from Waterloo, Ontario.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Waterloo's Perimeter Institute, our home away from home this past week. We've been here as part of the Equinox Summit, a gathering of scientists, policy experts, and industry representatives from around the world, all here to map out the technologies and strategies for a low-carbon, electrified future. And hi again, everybody. I'm Steve Paikin. Glad to have you with us for this final agenda program from this Equinox Summit. A reminder that our coverage extends well beyond what you see on your television sets tonight. We are streaming this broadcast online on our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Mike Miner is hosting a live chat there as well on the homepage. We hope you will dial him up and share your views with him. We're on Facebook as well, facebook.com/theagenda. And send us a tweet. Twitter.com, and the hashtags you can use are Your Agenda or Equinox Summit. Lots of ways for you to get involved with us tonight and tell us what you think. And speaking of thinking, they've been doing it a lot this week here at the Perimeter Institute. On Monday, we looked at the state of the environment and our use of carbon-intensive sources of energy. On Tuesday, we focused on the technologies that could make transportation more efficient. On Wednesday, we asked what energy-efficient buildings will look like over the next 20 years. Last night, Thursday, we debated the geopolitics of energy, and that brings us to tonight, where we consider the recommendations of this Equinox Summit to get us to the year 2030, fully electrified and without further damaging the planet. Here to help us do that, Barry Brook, Foundation Sir Hubert Wilkins Chair of Climate Change at the University of Adelaide in Australia. Walt Patterson, Associate Fellow of the Energy, Environment and Development Program at Chatham House in London, UK. Tom Rand, founder of the private venture capital fund VCI Green Funds in Toronto. Zoe Caron, climate policy and advocacy specialist for WWF Canada. And Jatin Nathwani, director of the Waterloo Institute for Sustainable Energy at the University of Waterloo. It's great to have you all on the program. I know some familiar faces here. Barry, who else? Tom, first time, Walt, first time to have you on as well, so it's great to have you all here. You know the three challenges, of course, that you've been looking at through the course of the week here, the generation, transmission, and storage of energy. So let's start to unpack that. And Barry, I'm going to put you to work first here. Geothermal power. That's one of the ideas you've been kicking around. Give us a thumbnail sketch of how that works.
Well, geothermal energy is an ancient source of heat that people have used from Roman times. And in recent times, we've used it to generate electricity in some places that are really very favorable, such as Iceland and even California. What we've been really talking about at the summit here is accessing deep resources from the Earth kilometres down. Now, that's going to require real technological breakthroughs to achieve that, but if we can do it and we can unlock the potential of those hot, dry rocks deep in the Earth, there is potentially unlimited energy down there, and most of the planet is actually then accessible for that source of low-carbon baseload electricity.
You say there's unlimited amounts of potential there, but I wonder, Tom, whether there's unlimited amounts of money waiting to make that happen. You're the VC guy.
Yeah.
You tell us.
Well, I would hesitate to call it a VC project. I think one of the things that we're realizing about clean tech and what makes it very different from IT or something like that is that it's infrastructure, it's project finance. And yeah. So what we've been working hard at this week is to define a concrete action that can be taken that would de-risk that technology at scale so that the private sector would come in and finance commercial scale projects. Because right now they won't do it, they see too much risk. Yeah. So it's really a project finance issue. Certainly the venture community, Potter Drilling, for example, Google's made an investment in them. So there's technology that will be brought to the project. But the fundamental barrier is unlocking patient capital for the projects.
Do you think that can be done?
Absolutely.
Why are you optimistic about that?
Well, I'm optimistic. We came up with the idea this week of getting a consortium together. So for about $1 billion, you can get a bunch of government heads together. Maybe Larry Page from Google can do that too. And if you build 10 big projects, demonstration around the world, you map the resource, what you'll do is you'll give some certainty to the price of the energy that you can produce, you'll de-risk the technology at scale, and you'll essentially demonstrate. You know, you walk up to a generator, put your hand on it, there it's working, there's the electricity, I guess I'll invest now. And so that's a very specific kind of activity, not a lot of capital, $1 billion for an international consortium. Private and public is not a lot of money, but it would unlock that really big treat which lies beneath our feet.
Throughout the course of the week, we have been showing little vignettes of various countries or places around the world which are doing interesting things in this regard. And even though Iceland has been in the news for all the wrong reasons over the last couple of years, here's a bright light. Iceland is erupting, if I can use this metaphor here, with geothermal energy. Thanks to its location, Iceland's geysers, its volcanoes, its underground lava, provide it with a vast geothermal potential. More than 80% of its energy already comes from renewable resources, and 85% of all homes are heated by geothermal energy. In fact, the island nation is considering building the world's longest undersea electric cable just to share its geothermal energy with the rest of Europe. And our packaging producer, David Irwin, I should also say, has mapped out Iceland's energy story on our website, so if you want to know more about what they're doing in Iceland about this, go to tvo.org/theagenda and click on the Iceland story. Now, Walt, not every country is Iceland, just like not every country was blessed to have oil in the ground. Exactly. Is this one of the stories where you're lucky if you got it, but if you don't, you can't?
I think the key point here is that Iceland has a lot of actual volcanic activity quite close to the surface. What we're talking about in the context of the new potential for geothermal is much deeper. It is likely to be down maybe 3-4, possibly as far as 5 kilometers underground. And the way you go after it is to send water down one well and crack it and send the hot steam back up another well. And this can be done, but it's a lot more expensive than just drilling into the side of a volcano.
Sure. Zoe, how do you like the potential of geothermal?
I think that it certainly does hold potential. I think it also points to the fact that in Canada, we should really be looking at, and some people actually are already looking at this, doing a renewable energy mapping of what exists in Canada. We know that it's probably really big, but that doesn't give us much more information in terms of regional potential. And there has been some mapping done, for sure, in Ontario and Nova Scotia and parts of other provinces, but pulling together a big picture, I think, will give us an idea of not only what we have in terms of geothermal, but also other types of renewable energy in the country. And that is not only energy, of course, for us, but also for potentially for export to the United States.
Do we do much of it here at all?
Do much?
Geothermal? In Canada?
I am not. We probably do.
We don't.
We don't do anything.
But what we do a lot of is drilling. Canada has an enormous amount of expertise in drilling. And as a matter of fact, most of the geothermal projects, a large proportion of them is done with Canadian expertise because we've been doing that for a long time, drilling in the ground. So we just need to drill for heat rather than drill for oil.
Jatin, how about storage? Is that an issue with this?
Not with geothermal, it's not an issue because you could almost consider geothermal as part of, think of it as baseload generation. So that would not be an issue with geothermal.
How about the storage issue in general then? That's one of the things you're looking at here.
Indeed, let me speak to the storage question because it emerged as one of the compelling themes at this summit. Storage has enormous implications for how we can actually make our energy system efficient and, for the example, enable large-scale intermittent generation such as wind and solar, both the large-scale as well as storage and its capabilities to get at the other end of the spectrum, which is the, call it micro levels of power generation for distributed resources and so on.
Walt, do you think developing storage technology, particularly, I guess, batteries for cars, that kind of thing, is there a breakthrough close enough by in our future that it would help deal with all of the issues that we're trying to tackle this week here?
We've been making batteries for a couple of centuries already. And the technologies have been evolving very slowly until recently. But now we're starting to look at much more interesting and much more promising combinations of materials, both for the kind of battery that you need in a car and the kind of battery that Jatin was referring to, which is likely to be quite a different battery. One, for example, one of the battery technologies that we have been, I think, persuaded to pursue a lot more with more enthusiasm this week is called a vanadium redox battery, in which you have a tank of water with electrodes in it, and that water electrolyte is actually the fuel of the battery, so to speak. So once you've discharged the battery, you can pump that particular load of electrolyte out, pump a fresh load in. It's just like putting petrol in or gasoline in your car. So this kind of technology has an awful lot of potential, but it still needs development, partly because we've got to bring the costs down.
I wonder, Barry, if part of the problem, I mean, we've heard so many good ideas here this week, all week in Waterloo, and I wonder if that's part of the difficulty. There's no one single thing everybody can unify around. Yeah, we like a little of this, we like a little of this, we like a little of this. Is that a problem?
No, it's not, because no one can tell what the future is going to bring. It's going to bring a mix of energies of some form. I suspect some of them will be much more dominant than others, but it's really hard to tell at this stage which ones will be the breakthrough technologies. And if anything about history we should learn, it's that it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen in the future, and so we should be hedging our bets.
Well, Tom, that's another issue. I know that Ballard, for example, has put tons of money into fuel cells and hydrogen cells, and yet they have not, they haven't exploded on the market in the way people had hoped.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of fuel cells, but not to defend any one technology. One of the things that we've certainly learned here is that it's a systems approach. Mm-hmm. So storage in particular, so the famous report, well, famous amongst us energy geeks, famous report from Sandia Labs down the States, very reputable place. There's 26 different actors, 26 different kinds of utilities and companies and so on that would benefit from storage on the grid. But not one of them would be able to pay enough to make that storage worthwhile. Hmm. So one of the questions is, how is it that you can either regulate or get some of those players together so that many players would want to pay for the same kilowatt hour of storage? Right? That's a systems approach. And so storage, there's been promising tech. There's some in Ontario right now, HydroStore, underwater compressed air, temporal power, ultra-low friction flywheels. So these are Ontario-based companies that can deliver grid-scale storage today. But there's never been a market for it. So the question is, how do you create that market? So because once storage is there, everyone benefits. The wind farm, the utility, the customer, the industrial user, they'll benefit.
It's a great question. What's the answer?
Well, I think the first answer is you do some large-scale demonstration projects based on a feed-in tariff for storage. You get the projects up and running at scale. Once you've done that, you can then export what's called a merchant model. And that's just good business, where you figure out, are there places where I can have more than one character benefit? So here in Toronto, for example, it's not here, but in Toronto, off the shores of Lake Ontario, we're going to build an underwater compressed air energy storage facility. Mm-hmm. The utility wants it because they have a lot of trouble getting power into downtown on a hot, sunny afternoon. So there's power sitting there in the lake they can take out and use during the day. At the same time, you can have that power on standby for an industrial user who might want to use it as well. And so if you can find a way to have more than one actor pay for it, you can make that plant pay for itself.
What's just back on the issue, Zoe, of battery-operated cars? We figured out, or I guess we reminded everybody, I guess a couple of nights ago here, that once upon a time, at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, battery-operated cars were the majority of the cars on the road. And then Henry Ford invented something, and that was the end of that. What do you think it will take in order to get, a significant number of battery-powered cars on the road so that we're not burning up oil the way we always have been?
Well, I think a piece of that is, of course, going back to renewable energy development to ensure that when we are using those, electric and battery-powered cars, that it's coming from a clean source of energy. So that's certainly a big piece of it. I think the other piece of it is shifting the way we use transportation within a city. I mean, I grew up driving a Dodge Dakota truck with a second gear that didn't work, and the passenger door always flew open, but I loved it, and I love driving, I really do, but now I use a Zipcar program, and I use a bike share program, and I wasn't into that before, and now I am, and I feel like our cities are really starting to shift how we do things now. We share transit and really making it something that's part of the status quo and not just something on the sidelines.
So Barry, a cultural shift in thinking is essential to everything you've talked about all week, I presume.
Sure. Look, we can't take one single action. We need serious action to address the energy supply problem, we also need to simultaneously be addressing the energy demand problem. And unless we solve both of those simultaneously, we are not going to cut greenhouse gases to the degree that's required, and we are not going to clean up not only our electricity supply, but transportation and all the other embedded energy that we have in our system. So look, the focus of this summit has been about mostly about technologies to enable that energy supply, but we've also talked seriously about technologies that enable people to take action and to initiate behavioural change, the sort of things that will stymie demand as well as supplying energy for growth, and most importantly for displacing fossil fuels, which is going to be key.
Just while you were talking there, there was a comment that came up from our live chat, somebody asking whether Sudbury, Ontario, which of course has a lot of deep holes in it from all the nickel mining that's taken place, would that be a good candidate, that city, for geothermal?
Probably. Robin, yeah. One of the experts on deep geo, said there's a new idea where you actually start the geothermal drilling a couple of kilometers down. So you build one large shaft that goes down. That can be done very cheaply. Mining companies know how to do that. And you start from down there. So Sudbury might have the first step already done.
Okay. One of the things we also talked about, Zoe, this past week was making our cities energy smart. And there's a growing number of smart cities which are building smart from the ground up, but these are often smaller places that are brand new. When you've got existing cities that aren't accustomed to, you know, having smart grids, smart energy systems and all that, it sounds like just a huge and daunting task to get them to buy in. How do you do it?
It is, I mean, I think one jurisdiction to look to that has just kind of made a plan around buildings in particular is California. They've just put out their kind of Energy 2050 plan. And in that plan, every building by the year 2050 will either be renovated and upgraded to efficiency standards, or new, or destroyed and a new one built. So they are actually completely redoing their building system because it's such a massive piece of the solution.
This is every public building in California?
You'd have to check the details in the report, but it's a massive transition that they're going through.
Not homes.
Someone else might be able to add to it. Not homes.
Not homes.
No.
Just buildings. Okay. Jatin, the summit document is looking to solar technology to bring electricity to the roughly 1.4 billion people who still don't have it. How can this happen?
Well, it's entirely credible it can happen, and I'm quite positive about it. It's probably one of the themes that emerged in this summit with a degree of passion and commitment that I would not have expected before we got going, and it emerged as a theme on itself. This idea that 2 billion or a third of the humanity has absolutely zero access to electricity is just an unconscionable proposition, and what can we do as the science and engineering and technology community to get at that question? So why is it credible, the notion of the solar, plastic solars, and to be able to get at the lower end of the energy requirement for communities that are remote and rural and low income, to provide that basic level of energy service, one light bulb, one next little quanta of energy that has such a powerful influence on quality of life, human development, and a whole range of other measures. And we have really turned our mind on that. It's there in the Equinox Summit summary, the idea that we want to think big. We really are looking at 500 million households, 2.5 billion people we want to get to. And I don't think the capital availability issues are all that significant, but that's energizing. And this came from, of course, with our science experts and checking the discussions around the validity of the technology and so on, but it was driven by our forum leaders, these change agents who were thinking, this is the way we want to change the world.
Let me follow up with you on this. You know, we're here in the province of Ontario. 100 years ago, a guy named Adam Beck made it all happen in terms of giving us, turning this, the light switches on. You know, in the United States, the Tennessee Valley Authority, FDR, got just massive electrification going across poor and, rural parts of the United States of America. That model doesn't seem like it's on in some of the poorer countries in this world. So how are you going to bring power to 500 million people who currently don't have it if governments can't undertake these massive electrification programs that they used to do routinely?
Yeah. Well, we can't snap our fingers and move sub-Saharan Africa and other developing places up to the living standards of the first world. I mean, we know that's impossible, but what we can do is enable a transition to that sort of society that takes a different pathway to what Western societies mapped out. We took an industrial pathway. We started in the Industrial Revolution in 1800 on the basis of intense energy and fossil fuels. we're now looking at a new development for a whole other continent in a different century, and I don't see why that can't take a different pathway. The sort of technologies Jatin was talking about, they're not going to enable, they're not going to run a stove, they're not going to power an air conditioner, but they are going to bring light, they're going to bring power to, for communications devices, and the ability to start to educate people and to put in place a system that's a bit different to what we've got here today.
And let me just make sure I got my numbers right. It's 1.4 billion people, but 500 million homes. Is that the distinction?
About 2.5 billion people.
Yeah, it's
2.5 billion.
2.5 billion people who have practically zero level of what you would call modern energy services. 2 billion of those have zero electricity, but it's of that order, 2.5 billion people.
So although, I should note, currently, that's not a climate change problem. I mean, these people produce almost no greenhouse gases. Hmm. But what we've got to do is avoid them going on a pathway where they will eventually. And so we've got to address the problem in the developed world, which is where all the greenhouse gases come from. Top 50 nations produce 90% of the world's greenhouse gases. We've got to nail that problem. But we've got to make sure we don't move on the wrong pathway elsewhere.
Sure. Although, Walt, I think I did read somewhere where even in Outer Mongolia, a farmer had a couple of photovoltaic tiles on his yaks. And that was somehow, you know, giving him the small amount of power that he needed in order to do what he needed to do. I mean, you really can bring it down to the bottom line like that, eh?
I remember seeing a photograph that delighted me of a camel carrying medical vaccines on its hump with solar panels keeping the vaccines cool. Solar refrigeration is a lovely thermodynamic judo. I really like that. The hotter the sun is, the cooler the system gets it.
Gotcha. Okay, let's get into one of the more controversial aspects of your work of this past week, and that is, we're just going to hit it on the head, nukes. This summit document came out in support of nuclear technology, which I'm sure won't make everybody thrilled. Go ahead, Zoe. What do you think? Nukes.
Zoe's going to argue for nukes.
I saw her with a deep sigh as I was just leading into that question. So
I really have to work on this face, all these expressions. No. Just to clarify that it was, we looked at a very specific nuclear technology at this forum, and that's called thorium, which is actually named after the Greek god of Thor, which brought up a lot of jokes throughout the week as well. But thorium is one of a number of technologies that are out there right now that are trying to figure out how do we use the plutonium and uranium waste that is out there now and actually use that to generate nuclear energy instead of continuing to mine. There's obviously still controversy with this. We're still actually producing nuclear waste, but we agreed as a forum that it was worth looking into because you have that fuel source that's already there. It was a technology to look into to see if it was feasible and to obviously assess whether what the environmental impacts are in comparison. There's a lot of work obviously to do, but it is a possibility that's out there.
Let me put it this way. Environmental groups around the world can't stand nuclear power, and they've been trying to get us out of it for almost all the time. There are very few who are prepared to sanction nukes of any kind, for all of the reasons we know. But you've agreed to look at it at this summit. What does that indicate?
Well, let me first separate myself from my organization for just a moment. I was here in my individual capacity, I would say. I wasn't advocating any organization that I'm a part of while I was here. I don't think you need an environmental organization to endorse further research and development into something. I think that there are some things that could be big enough game changers that could help shift things. But I think one of the reasons why environmental organizations don't necessarily, some don't even look at nuclear, they just push it aside. And part of that is because renewable energy is just so much more important to focus on and try and drive forward. So perhaps a way of thinking of it is prioritization, not yes or no. So that's a way that some people think of it, I guess.
Walt, I see you nodding at that.
That's exactly the point I would make, that one of the issues that, for reasons of organization this week, we have not really been able to confront is the question of priorities. If you ask a politician about an energy issue, the politician will say, oh, well, we need all of the above. Mm-hmm. Well, this is like saying full speed ahead in all directions. You can't do it. You actually have to decide where are the best places to allocate your resources and your effort, your time and money and skills, in order to advance the agenda that you're looking for.
Okay, and Barry, does thorium advance the agenda?
Thorium might. I think there's a number of advanced nuclear technologies. There's also uranium-based ones. Now, with respect, I totally disagree with my panel members that it shouldn't be a really high priority. I think it's one of the major baseload low-carbon solutions. And speaking as a climate scientist, my fundamental goal is to retire those coal-fired power stations, to get us off oil, to avoid those emissions. And I see advanced nuclear power, where you recycle the fuel, as really fundamental to that. To give you a picture of really what I'm talking about, every one of us in our lifetime uses a coal equivalent of about 800 elephants. So you can imagine them piled up behind you. You could get a lump of nuclear waste the size of a golf ball that would fulfill that same potential. So consuming nuclear waste, providing massive amounts of energy that's zero carbon, you don't even have to mine the uranium anymore. I see that as a huge potential game changer.
Tom?
I'd make the point, I'd separate out what you want to put your efforts on in terms of finances. The real money is in building the infrastructure. Tens of trillions of dollars are going to get deployed, you know, in the next few years on fossil fuel infrastructure, never mind non-fossil fuel infrastructure. So the big money is in building the commercial projects. When you're talking about, you know, advancing some research into Gen 4 nuclear reactors or building a prototype thorium reactor, it's peanuts compared to that. So I agree you have to have priorities as you move forward and make installations and commit to infrastructure. But I think it's very important to keep your options open from a technical perspective, because you don't start to commit the real money until you commit to commercial size rollouts. So Gen 4 reactors, for example, Three Mile Island killed all research in the United States into Gen 4 reactors. If we had done that research until now, we would have nuclear plants that, if there was what happened in Japan, there's passive safety systems, so you don't rely on a backup generator. So there are fundamental design shifts that could have been in place. That said, nuclear is extremely expensive, and whatever technology you happen to fall in love with, the rubber hits the road on the cost of project finance.
Well, yeah. I see Barry shaking his head, but the fact is these projects always go over budget. They're extremely expensive.
I would disagree. Let's look at the best example in the world, which is France. They've, more than any other developed economy, have decarbonized their energy supply. They were based on oil-fired power stations and hydroelectricity. France's electricity demand has since grown about threefold since the 1970s. 1979, their first commercial nuclear power station opened. 1999, their 59th station opened. They built that number of stations in 20 years, and they were building a massive amount. France has amongst the cheapest electricity in Europe.
Are you talking about Areva?
Well, Areva is the government-run electricity.
How's their plan in Finland doing?
Well, their plan in Finland is like a new offshore wind farm, or it's like a new solar thermal plant. It's the first of a kind of a new generation of nuclear power. It's running about 30% over budget, just like almost any new project does. If you look at the decisions made by the developing world, who are pretty keen on making prudent investments, India is going to buy six more of those same plants that they're building in Finland. China is going to build two more of them. So it hasn't put them off. Nuclear should be competing on a fair and level playing field with the other technologies. And you don't need to argue about whether it's too expensive or not. The market will help choose that as long as you give it the right conditions.
That's not entirely true, because the government underwrites the insurance on the project. The government underwrites the cost of disposal long term. So existing nuclear plants do have hidden subsidies. What's interesting about what the Perimeter Institute and the Equinox was proposing was Gen 4s don't have that problem. You probably could insure a Gen 4 nuclear reactor because it has a different kind of safety system. I mean, I'm making that claim. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, right? But the point is, we can find that out only by putting that option on the table. And committing to spend a few billion dollars globally to find out whether that would work or not is peanuts compared to what we're spending melting tar in Alberta. So I think from a technology perspective, not to fall in love with technology, we have some policy problems, we have some, you know, there's lots of other things, it's not a magic bullet. But in terms of spending money, having priorities, it's not much to fund this kind of R&D. Sounds like a lot of billion dollars, but internet, you know.
Jatin, let me hear from you.
Let's go to China. And this is the most fascinating development. You said, you know, people object to nuclear in this part of the world, and yes, they do, and this debate. That is, where do you think the emerging demand for energy emerges in China? Vast amount of coal will either go up into the atmosphere or not. And here, the Chinese government is, of course, committing to enormous amount of renewable resources, and so are they to nuclear. They have a plan from 80, they've changed it to 70, but a very serious commitment to looking at large numbers of nuclear reactors to be brought on stream. Not only are they just saying we'll take one brand and just continue to build that, the amount of intellectual, scientific, and financial commitment that they've made to really get at the question of all different kinds of nuclear fuel cycles, and their strategy, do you know what it is? To export nuclear power plants, and we'll be buying them one of these days if we don't get it right.
We'll be buying theirs.
I wouldn't be surprised. Well, this is a guess, but you know.
Walt, you are a nuclear scientist, aren't you?
I used to call myself a lapsed nuclear physicist.
You want to explain what that means?
It means that, among other things, I was never a nuclear engineer, but when I began to look closely back at the end of the 60s and from then on, when I began to look closely at... You often hear people say that the public doesn't like nuclear power because it doesn't understand it. The longer I studied it, the more concerned I got. Not necessarily about the safety aspects of it, but about the complexity and the inflexibility and the cost that it got. The track record of building nuclear power plants according to the original specifications, the original estimated cost, and the original time schedule is abysmal worldwide. I have to say, by the way, that France is now importing more oil than it was importing in the mid-70s. So the nuclear plants that they've built have not taken them off the oil addiction. So there are a lot of issues that we probably couldn't go into in the kind of detail we'd need to address this problem tonight. But I think if you consider this from the priorities point of view, I would agree with Tom and Jatin that I have no problem with a certain amount of money being put into research and development to find out what could be done. The difficulty is that even a single plant of a nuclear prototype is going to cost us at least $1 billion, probably closer to $2 billion. And that single plant will probably take 10 years to get it online. So by the time we actually find out what we would learn from that, it will be too late to take advantage of that to do very much about the climate issue.
Let me get Barry to speak to that, because I mean, it is a fact that you've got at least 10 years of environmental assessment ahead of you once you've announced you want to buy a plant, or excuse me, you want to build a plant. Communities are almost always up in arms against putting it in their, you know, their neck of the woods. People love the fact that there's no CO2 emissions going up into the air, but there's a lot of mining of uranium that messes up the planet a little bit, you know, as you're trying to build these things. On balance, you're still that bullish on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a number of reasons. You can do a whole life cycle analysis. You can take account of that mining and still find nuclear is amongst the lowest carbon forms of electricity on a par with wind without backup. We're talking about advanced fuel cycles here that require no uranium mining at all. We've already mined enough uranium to power the whole world and these reactors, should we so choose, for about 500 years. So we're talking about a long-term energy solution. And look, I think we have to pursue all of these options, but we can't be ruling out nuclear on ideological grounds. And as a scientist, and as a climate scientist especially, that really worries me. We can't imagine we're going to solve the climate problem in 10 years. We're not. We've got so much momentum in our industrial system, it's going to take decades. And by 2050, 2030, 2050, the sort of timeframes we were looking at this summit, I suspect we could have many terawatts of new nuclear power deployed. And that would be terrific, and that would be a major contribution.
Go ahead, Jatin.
There's a paradigm shift around nuclear. We've talked about its long-term costs and risks and public opposition and so on. But you should also be thinking about what we call modular reactors, or some people call it the baby nukes, as it were. So here now you're looking at a whole way of thinking about nuclear technology dispersed or distributed. These are 50 to 100 megawatt scale reactors that could be scaled up. And so that changes the whole equation on how we may think about nuclear, and those sorts of advanced developments are currently underway as part of our thinking here at the summit.
Well, you've got the floor. Let me ask a follow-up here, because the document that emerges from this summit calls for, quote, nuclear power that closes the nuclear fuel cycle.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, that means that you literally take the waste, which is an unresolved problem to date, and you're going to turn that waste, the high-level nuclear waste, which we're studying and trying to find ways how to dispose it in a final way. You will not do that. You will take that waste and recycle it, basically. We recycle other things in life. This is another strategy to do the same.
Can we do that?
That's the plan. That's exactly the reactor systems we were discussing, the two options that were put forth, the fast reactor and the thorium-based one.
And Zoe, let me get you to follow up on something that Barry just said. He said there is an ideological opposition to nuclear power among too many quarters, I guess, in this world. Is he right about that?
You know, I'm not an expert on nuclear, so I'm not sure if I can answer that correctly. But one thing that was said, which is interesting to me, and I have to try not to honestly start crying when people say it because I think about it every day, is that we're not going to solve climate change in the next 10 years. And And it's, I don't know, maybe, and maybe we won't, but I just feel like if we wake up every day telling ourselves that, that we're not going to address it in 10 years, then what are we doing? I mean, if, you know, if a family member of yours gets diagnosed with cancer and they say, okay, you have, you know, your dad is probably going to die in the next year, but, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, then maybe he'll be okay. Would you just say, well, you know, he's probably not going to be okay, so let it go? I mean, that's the thing about this Equinox Summit, which I found so inspiring, which I haven't found in a long time, is that our day-to-day conversations were a conversation about what we can do and what we will do, and not about all the things we can't do or probably can't do. And that was exciting to me, even if it was just for 4 days, and even if it's allowing us to take a step out of what might be a very real reality. That's the type of conversation that we need to have on all levels, and that was a good move forward.
Barry?
From a purely climate science perspective, it would be ideal if we could cut our emissions 100% or even 80% by 2030. But if that doesn't happen, the world doesn't end. It just means we have a bit more warming to adapt to and we have more cost to cope with. Fundamentally, we've got to do it as quickly as possible, and what I'm trying to do is combine that knowledge that we have to do it fast with a realization that we have to do it in some practical way. We've got to supply the new power, we've got to manage demand to stop demand growth exploding, and together we've got to pull those carbon emissions down. If we can cut them by even 50% by 2050, we may be able to avoid 2 or 3 degrees warming. I don't want to be there. 2 to 3 degrees is too much, but even 50% will get us there. If we can cut them by 100% by 2050, which would be my hope, we may well avoid too much serious problems and gradually drag that temperature back down again.
Walt, if you're going to be consistent, can you be against global warming and against nuclear power?
Oh, yes. Climate change and global warming. Nuclear power needs climate change more than climate change needs nuclear power.
What do you mean?
until the Toronto Conference in 1988, when climate suddenly hit the political agenda in a big way, nuclear power was on its knees. Nobody wanted to buy any nuclear plants because they were costing way too much money and performing far too badly.
And then nuclear came climate change.
Nuclear power seized climate change like a drowning man seizes the last log, and has been riding it ever since. And I personally feel that nuclear is something of a cuckoo in the nest, that nuclear, because of its resource demands, will mop up a lot of the money and a lot of the skills and certainly an awful lot of the time and political commitment, which would be better applied elsewhere in the package. If we had lots of time, if climate was not an urgent issue, I'd be perfectly happy to let people go on trying different reactor designs and funding the research that explores whether they work and so on. It's a fascinating technology.
But that's
very
not where
fascinating
we are.
Technology.
Tom?
But that's not what we need.
Yeah, I think that's actually a fair point. And one of the dangers you get into when you fall in love with technological solutions, and I back fully the idea behind the summit, which is that we look at what options we can get on the table in 2030 and so on. There's a lot we can do now.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a hotel in Toronto. It's a co-development. We've lowered our carbon by 3/4 using bog standard technology that's
Absolutely.
Available today. That's a 3/4 cut. Buildings Absolutely. Account for 40% of our greenhouse
using
gas.
Using what technology?
Solar thermal, solar PV, geothermal, LED lighting, smart thermostats, good insulation. It's not hard to do, right? But you just put it all in one place. And we did it at a profit. So the loan payments on the retrofits are less than the energy savings. If we did that to every building in Canada, we would more than meet Kyoto. We would stimulate local demand for all these technologies. You can't outsource engineering and trades. So there's very low-hanging fruit.
Well, what's stopping us from doing it?
It's boring.
You know, that's the key. It's the most exciting thing I've ever done.
We have exciting lives, we promise.
Don't just stop holding back. Tell me what you really think, okay? Tell me. Yeah.
No, really.
That's a serious problem.
The
really dull, boring stuff like thermal insulation, the stuff we know how to do and which we could do tomorrow or even this evening if we wanted to, we don't do. Because for one reason or another, people don't get excited about it.
There's a famous curve called the McKinsey curve that shows the cost of carbon abatement. Starting on the left, it's negative cost, and ending on the right, it's a high cost. The cheapest, the one that basically you get richer by doing, is insulation in your attic. And on the far right, the most expensive is CCS. We have a federal government that has decided to back fully with lots of money and lots of might, lots of industrial partners, CCS. We just got a little bit of a drop on the eco energy thing on the homes. I mean, come on, there's a lot of energy efficiency. So the problem is these are the unsexy clean tech poor cousins, right? And as someone who's in love with technology, I get it. But the point is, if your objective is to cut carbon, there's an enormous amount we can do today. Simultaneously, while super smart people at the Perimeter Institute look at thorium and enhanced geothermal and so on, we need both. But looking at this is no excuse not to do this.
Okay, that's but here's right. What I don't get. We live in a province where a premier once won 4 elections in a row because he said bland works. We don't mind bland, thank you, William Davis. We don't mind bland when it works, when it puts the puck in the net.
Yeah.
So why do we have a problem with these solutions if the worst thing you can say about them is they're boring? Why aren't we doing them?
Honest answer for me, straightforward, I don't think the public yet knows what's coming their way in terms of climate change.
Yes.
I think if the public knew
what
was deserts, our bread baskets will be deserts. I mean, this keeps me up at night. And I think if the public knew that, they would be a little more proactive, to be honest. And that's just my personal view. But at the end of the day, it is about simply, the initiative can be education. You have best practices made publicly available. So there's a lot of behavioral change and just little nudges to get people moving in the right direction.
Okay.
I think it should be really unhip to be energy inefficient.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds like a good plan.
Right.
Let's do a little business with the folks at home, and then I want to bring up the George Monbiot graphic if I can after that. Reminder. This is our last night here. We've spent 5 nights here at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. The Equinox Summit has been looking into our energy future. They have created a blueprint, which we're discussing tonight, some ideas to get us to a world which uses a heck of a lot less carbon to keep the lights on by the year 2030. We urge you to go to our website, tvo.org/theagenda, to learn more about this summit, to see some web-exclusive videos and motion graphics on energy use and the challenges we face. Once again, tvo.org/theagenda. Okay, let me find this thing from... you all know George Monbiot? You know George Monbiot in the hall here? Yes, okay. Anti-global warming activist, writer in the UK, surprised many of his fellow activists, I guess, when he came out in favor of nuclear power despite the Fukushima disaster. And if you look at this graphic, you'll see this is George's idea for what the right mix ought to be. 40% renewables, 40% nuclear, 15% carbon capture and storage, and the rest of our energy mix, natural gas without carbon capture and storage. Let's get into this. Jatin, what do you think of the mix?
He's kind of got it about right. You can quibble with the numbers, but if it's, let's say, a large amount of renewables, the 40%, if you can find a way, and this is the storage would be really a significant part of how you could turn it into base load generation. So that, if you can take the intermittency question out and begin to get large-scale renewables with storage, it almost gets you to what you're searching for, which is base load solution. You're turning renewables into base load solutions, promising that way. And once you begin to have the scale and if the resources are there in terms of land and so on, that kind of gets you there. He's absolutely correct when he's got gas on the margin. So in essence, and that is the correct view, because you do not want to really put your future on natural gas, although it appears abundant today. It's a valuable resource that is there for fertilizers, food, and other resources. It may not, it's not what you want to put your energy policy on, because it actually also emits a vast amount of carbon. If you turn on one coal plant and you have twice as many gas plants, then in essence you've undone any benefit of turning off a coal plant.
Barry, what's your view on, obviously he's trying to get rid of all the fossil fuels, and that's his energy mix for doing so. Do you like his numbers?
Yeah, he's hedged his bets. You know, he's saying a bit of nuclear, a bit of renewables, let's see which one wins out, and that's very much my argument. I'm not advocating we should just follow one pathway. Inherent in that figure as well is that he's accepted that Britain's really got to cut its energy use as well. Not necessarily cut on an absolute scale, but if you're going to move ahead for the next 50 years and have that sort of energy mix, you're going to have to continue to do things much more efficiently, induce behaviour change, have heat pumps, a whole range of things that goes into that package. It looks very simple. It's not really that simple underpinning it. So I think most countries need some sort of solution like that. Some may be able to do more renewables, I don't know. Some may be able to do a lot more nuclear where they haven't got any favourable renewable resources.
How about in your home country, Australia? How does it work?
Well, Australia right now is coal. I mean, that's basically all. It's coal with a bit of gas on the margin. There's a lot of debate there about whether we could go to 100% renewables. I'm pretty sceptical. I'm a scientist. I'm sceptical. And I don't think we could necessarily dictate any path like that.
How much nuclear do you have in Australia?
We have one research reactor, so not really a lot of experience and no commercial power. So
why don't
one
you
of the
buy
big
some
debates,
of our ACL reactors then?
Well, yeah, I mean, we mine a lot of uranium. We're one of the world's biggest uranium miners, along with Canada. If you have an ACL reactor, you don't even need to enrich that uranium. It is a possibility. These things are being debated in Australia. Nothing's being resolved right now. We're arguing about how to increase our renewable energy penetration. All the while, we're also talking about building more coal-fired power stations. We need something to cut through that debate.
Your government's talking about more coal-fired stations?
A lot of governments around the world are. Germany's got 29 new coal-fired power stations on the drawing board. I mean, we are seeing serious problems, sort of behind the scenes that people don't want to talk about, of many, many nations planning a lot more coal. And unless we really deal fundamentally with that problem and have all of the options on the table, we're in trouble.
Well, let's hit that on the head. Zoe, we hear this expression, clean coal. Is there really such a thing?
I would say that there is cleaner coal, but I don't know if I would call it clean. I mean, it is a development in the coal industry for sure, and it has definitely cleaned up our air from dirty particles. It hasn't solved the entire problem. I mean, that's my opinion on it.
Walt, how about the Monbiot mix? What do you think?
Well, I am deeply skeptical that it could be achieved.
Which part of it?
Well, for starters, the nuclear part. I don't think we'd get it if we tried. So I'm very unhappy about that. I think we could do much better with the renewables. But the problem is that this is all supply. This is all talking about what we are going to produce in terms of electricity without paying any attention at all about what we're going to do with the electricity. My own feeling is that if we were really serious about energy policy rather than fuel and electricity policy, we would start with the uses. We'd actually examine the way we use electricity. I mean, that actually came up this week in some of the work that was being done.
What is that a reference to? You mean conservation or what?
Well, conservation is about fuel. Conservation is about fuel because you can stop using it.
So when you say use, what do you mean?
I'm talking about performance. I'm talking about better performance, particularly by all the various electrical devices we use and the systems that actually deliver the electricity and deliver the services. We are way, way, way below what we know we can achieve with this. But we don't put in, we put all our policy analysis and all our political will into providing more electricity. It's like opening the taps wider without putting a plug in the bath. I mean, we really need to start thinking about putting a plug in the bath as the top priority. I mean, Tom's talking about getting the buildings right. That's crucial. Absolutely crucial. If we did that, if we put our focus on that, rather than building more plants of any kind, even including more renewables, I think we would find that in OECD countries, at least the rich countries, we would cut the use of electricity, not increase it, even allowing for the additional uses for transport and things like that.
Tom,
I'm sure this is possible.
Yeah, I think Walt's really onto something here, and we need to start thinking about energy as a service, not a commodity.
Yeah.
So what I mean by one of the things that we can't talk about is increasing the price of energy. Somehow, really smart people and lots of capital is supposed to be deployed so quickly on such a scale that everyone can keep doing what they're doing. You can still drive really powerful cars. You can have a retail shop where the doors are open and the air conditioning pours into the street because it's good for business. You're allowed to not change your behavior one whit, which makes the job of the people who are trying to solve this problem 100 times harder. So an adult conversation about climate change says to the public, you're going to have to pay twice as much for energy. We're going to make it easier for you. So, you know, we're going to subsidize some home heating bills. We're going to do lots of eco-home energy audits for you. We're going to help you insulate your attic, whatever. We're going to soften the blow.
Would you take the HST off home heating?
No, absolutely not. I'd quadruple it. But the point is, you can't do that in a political environment. I'm going to run on a platform with double the price of energy.
Right.
We have to have a public that understands what's coming. Right. This is not an option, like the decarbonating our economy in 20, 30 years. If we don't do it, this is all over.
Well, this is one of the key questions that emerges from this week. Zoe, how about you first on this one? Will technological innovation be so fantastic that we won't have to change the way we live our lives? Because I know there's lots of people out there who hope the answer to that is yes.
That's a fine line. I think that there is technology that can help us change the way that we live our lives, first of all. And I don't think that means having a lower quality of life either. I mean, let's think really simple things, like for my generation, it's totally normal for on your phone to get alerts about your balance from your statement account. It's like, okay, you only have $5 left in your account. You should probably know that. You know, don't go spending anything more. I get alerts on my phone in terms of how much phone usage left I have in the month. Why can't I get something on my phone that says, okay, you've hit this much energy usage per month. Do you realize that that's the provincial average? Okay, you want to up that for the month? Fine, go ahead. But that's going above and beyond. So there's some kind of recognition about what we're doing. I mean, there's a role for technology to play, I think, that helps us shift things. So I also think that we can do a lot without it, and I think the technology can play a whole role in and of itself. It's definitely not a straight shot either way.
I don't think this is the best of all possible worlds.
Sorry, which one are you referring to?
The world we're in right here in this room. We're lucky, we're fortunate, but I don't think our lives are necessarily as good as they could be. And I think the idea of changing lifestyles has an upside as well as a downside. That if you didn't spend 2.5 hours every day in a traffic jam, for example, you know, as soon as you start thinking about it, the things that you don't like about what you do every day, the possibility of changing those things for the better with the help of more intelligent energy systems, more better managed and better designed energy systems, I think the upside is there. I don't think it's a question necessarily of finding that we are suffering more. I think it may well be that it will reduce the suffering, even for the rich ones, never mind the poor ones.
Okay, Jatin, your turn.
I'm with Walt on this one. So he got annoyed about buildings and being boring. Now I would like to propose make them sexy and cool.
Absolutely.
And this is where we're going. And
but not too cool.
You've just touched upon it, because this is the set of solutions. By cool, I really want to get them smart.
Yes.
And this is the notion
Absolutely.
Of smart devices and our ability to really get at the question of our patterns of energy use in a way that we can actually influence it in a downward direction by direct intervention, or for that matter, this number of technologies that allow you to do it in what I call the set and forget proposition. And so when we move down that path, I think there is enormous potential for what we're talking about is demand side management or reduction of energy use. And that ought to be done, should be done, should be a focus and a priority. But I think we also have to take a realistic view that the challenge in front of us is actually quite enormous, and the supply question side also will have to play a part.
Barry, you want to weigh in on this?
I'm a high-tech sort of guy. I would love to think that a silver bullet could solve this, or perhaps a uranium bullet. But ultimately, I'm quite happy for us to have a multiplicity of solutions to do this and to tackle the problem from both the supply side and the demand side. The fundamental point for me is I don't want to bet my planet on being wrong. And so I don't want to arbitrarily rule out anything, and I don't want to have the whole of human society make a mistake from which they can't recover. We've really got too much at stake here.
Walt, I must confess, when you said I'm not sure this is the best of all worlds, I thought you were talking about the hereafter for a second. But you did mean this one.
I mean this one.
You meant we could improve this one here.
I mean this one has got lots of room for improvement, even, as I say, for those fortunate ones like us. And as I say, as my colleagues have pointed out, we spent quite a bit of time this week talking about the people who are not that fortunate and what needs to be done with their help and their cooperation to bring them up into a kind of world that we can all enjoy and all share in a much more equitable way.
In our last minute, Tom, let me ask you, is there enough money out there to make all this happen? Sounds expensive.
No question. There's $3 trillion sitting on corporate balance sheets right now. There's 100 and some odd trillion sitting in pension funds. I would make the argument pension funds have a fiduciary duty to fund low carbon technology, because their job is to meet the needs of their beneficiaries 30 years from now. If we don't solve this problem, I don't think they're going to be able to meet those needs. So the capital's there. The challenge we have, how do we shape the market to move that capital? The market's not a natural kind like a tree that we discover the laws of it. It's more like an iPod. We engineered it, right? We invented credit default swaps and all that. So the challenge is, how do we engineer the market to solve this problem and unleash the power of the market to solve this problem? That's a very powerful tool, but to do it, we need to have bold, decisive, long-term policy commitments to solve this problem.
Yeah.
I want to thank all five of you for putting the icing on what has been a very delicious cake that we've enjoyed eating this past week here in Waterloo. Five really wonderful nights here. watching you folks do what you do at the Equinox Summit. So thank you so much to our guests for participating tonight. Thanks to our audience for coming out this evening and participating in their own way for what has transpired here over the last 5 days here at the Perimeter Institute. For more information on tonight's guests and, in fact, on this entire Equinox Summit, we urge you to visit our homepage. That's tvo.org/theagenda. All of the programs this week were produced by our Equinox trio. That's Vodek Schemberg, Sandra Jonas, and Allison Buckenterrell. Thanks a lot, you guys. Great job this week. I want to thank our crew, cameramen here and here and here. Michael Smith and his team up in the back did a very nice job all week long, guys. It was great to work with you, as always. And, of course, the staff here at the Perimeter Institute, who were really just lovely to us, extremely hospitable, made this a wonderful home away from home to be at for the past 5 days. Thank you for the staff of PI. Stay with us. We're back in a moment with a look at what we've got coming up on Monday's agenda program, and we'll do that right after this.
Join Alan Gregg in conversation online for India Week. Watch past episodes of Alan's conversations with guests that have the deepest understanding of India, its people, and culture.
It is famously one of the most beautiful places in the world.
I feel I connected with my soul at certain points.
Is India going to be one of the great economic giants of the next century?
Alan Gregg in conversation, the India Online miniseries at tvo.org. Online anytime. The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
And that is the agenda for Friday, June 10th, 2011. Monday night, we're back in the studio in Toronto, and we take a closer look at work. First up, Al Gore's former speechwriter, a guy named Dan Pink, on what motivates us to be better workers. And then a debate about mismatches in Ontario's labor market, why we don't have the right people for the right jobs. Hope you'll join us for that discussion. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org. And for the last time this week, we say goodnight from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario.